From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. Good morning. I'm John Horn in for Larry Mantle. This week, our critics Leo Lowenstein, Wade Major, and Charles Solomon review Animal Crackers. It's an animated film starring Emily Blunt and John Krasinski. The HBO documentary Stockton on My Mind, it follows Michael Tubbs' tenure as the first African-American mayor of his hometown of Stockton, California. We'll also hear about the Canadian crime thriller Most Wanted, starring Jim Gaffigan and Josh Hartnett, plus my interview with director and producer Linda Goldstein-Knowlton about her documentary, We Are the Radical Monarchs. It spotlights an Oakland-based alternative to the Girl Scouts for young girls of color. All that and more film reviews are just ahead on Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. It's Film Week. I am John Horn sitting in for Larry Mantle. I'm the host of the LA Studios podcast, Hollywood the Sequel. Coming up on today's show, we'll chat with director and producer Linda Goldstein-Knowlton. Her new documentary, We Are the Radical Monarchs, follows the Oakland scouting troop, the Radical Monarchs, and explores their mission to train young girls to be the next generation of social justice activists. But first, joining us to review this week's new releases are Wade Major, film critic for KPCC and synagogues.com, Leo Lowenstein, film columnist for the Santa Monica Daily Press, and Charles Solomon, film critic for KPCC, Animation Scoop, and Animation Magazine. Wade, Leo, Charles, a virtual welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Virtual greetings.
So let's begin with the animated film Animal Crackers. It's a co-production among the United States, China, and Spain. It's directed by Scott Christianseva and Tony Bancroft, Emily Blunt, John Krasinski, and Ian McKellen star, along with Danny DeVito and Sylvester Stallone. Charles, let's get going with you.
Well, this was actually completed in 2017, and it's been on the shelf since then, where it should have stayed, as it's pretty terrible. The plot is so convoluted and needlessly complicated that the filmmakers, the characters, and the audience keep tripping over the snarls. There's magic that works some ways sometimes and not others. There are characters who appear and disappear. And then you play the usual game of, oh, that's designed like Mr. Incredible. That's the I Just Want to Be King montage from Lion King. There are the animal designs so similar to the animals from the Madagascar franchise. It just doesn't work.
Wade, can you add anything to that?
I can add very little. I have a conflict of interest where this film's concerned. I actually know two of the main producers quite well, and my wife was hired to deliver it to Netflix. So I kind of lived with this film for about 6 months. So I have very little objectivity and perspective on it. But I will say that I really love a lot of the voice casting. Patrick Warburton can do no wrong by me, and as many times as I've seen this film on a loop in the house over the many months, he consistently makes me laugh. So I will always give props to Patrick Warburton.
We're talking about Animal Crackers. It's directed by Scott Christianseva and Tony Bancroft and starring Emily Blunt and John Krasinski. It's unrated, and it's streaming on Netflix. Now let's go to We Are the Radical Monarchs. It's a documentary. It's directed by Linda Goldstein-Knowlton, and it's about an alternative group to the Girl Scouts, specifically for young girls of color. And the film follows the first ever Radical Monarchs troop in Oakland over the course of 3 years. Leo.
I really love this documentary. As you said, John, it looks at an alternative to the Girl Scouts formed by two women of color. The idea was, and this is in the Oakland area, to offer a group where girls of color specifically could become empowered. They learn about LGBTQ issues. They learn about environmental activism. They learn about Black Lives Matter. And this all sounds like a lot for young girls who are 7, 8, 9 years old. But what's important about it is that it gets them from a very young age to start thinking about representation of girls and women in media, to think about alternatives to general forms of indoctrination that they may have been seeing in the media. And it's a really, really powerful, reassuring, and inspirational kind of look at what's possible. It's not anti-Girl Scout at all. It just simply offers a more progressive and kind of a hopeful path. Now, of course, there have been those who have attacked the movements of the Radical Monarchs and in the Twitter and cancel culture generation. We've seen that. But there have also been pleas to establish more radical monarch groups, and this has happened across the, or starting to happen slowly across the country. But I thought it was a wonderful and very inspiring film.
Charles?
Well, I think it's, you respond more to the cast than the filmmaking. You really see these girls over the course of the film gain confidence, and one girl who's too shy to more than whisper when she's kind of hiding behind something becomes one of the most outspoken in the troupe. And it's, again, as Lael says, it's very upbeat, it's reassuring, it's affirming. One thing that puzzled me is that there don't seem to be any Asian girls in the troupe, although Oakland is, I believe, about 15% Asian population. And I wondered about that. But you would have to be an absolute Grinch not to be taken with these girls and watching them grow and mature and develop ideas and learning to express them.
The other thing that I think is interesting about this film is, even though it was 4 years in the making, what the girls start talking about, things like Black Lives Matter, immigration, even rent relief, are incredibly topical now. And I imagine that these girls, who are now a little bit older than they were in the film, are probably out there marching and making sure that these issues are not forgotten. We Are the Radical Monarchs is the name of the documentary. Linda Goldstein-Knowlton is its director and producer. It's unrated. It's available now via PBS.org and the PBS app. And again, we'll hear more on the making of this film when we talk to Linda later this hour. Coming up next, the Canadian crime thriller Most Wanted. It's written and directed by Daniel Robie. It's about a journalist trying to prove a man's innocence after he was forced into a dangerous drug deal against his will. It stars Antoine Olivier Pallon, Jim Gaffigan, and Josh Hartnett. Wade, what do you think of the journalist trying to do good work?
Boy, I have all kinds of admiration for the actual people on whom this story is based. It is it's a really fascinating story. I did a little bit of research after the fact on it. I just wish that the execution were up to the intent. A for effort, C for maybe C plus for execution. I think part of the problem is that it's a fairly convoluted story, and you jump around a lot. It's basically the story of a guy, kind of a street kid who winds up being duped into a drug deal and where he's not really the guilty party, but you know, justice is not served. And Josh Hartnett plays the journalist who was on top of this story, a guy who's kind of trying to redeem his career as well and not just be a stringer. And so there are a lot of different character arcs that are all overlapping and interconnecting. And you jump around between them so frequently that it's a little bit disorienting. It's hard to sort of wrap yourself around any one storyline, any one part of the story. They couldn't quite synchronize all of the simultaneous events, and it's unfortunate because it really deserves a better film. It's not a bad film, but I do think that the topic is a little bit too cumbersome for what they tried to do.
Lael?
I pretty much agree with Wade. I'm all for crusading journalists, and anytime you got a Spotlight or a Woodward and Bernstein or anything like that where, you know, a journalist is trying to expose corruption, I am just by nature going to be interested in it. However, having said that, this is one of the sort of least gripping crime thrillers that I could imagine. Like Wade said, there's just too many story arcs going on at one time. You don't feel terribly invested in the characters, even though it's quite a remarkable story. And the stuff that this is based on is really interesting. The fact that the guy who's arrested just happened to have the same name as someone who was a criminal, but this guy wasn't. So, it just does show the failure of this particular legal system and some interesting things about the Thai prison system. So that was, in that respect, it was interesting, but it was really just sort of a little bit anemic.
And would we buy Josh Hartnett if he walked into the KPCC newsroom and said he was a journalist?
Yes, I think you would.
Okay. That is Most Wanted. It's from writer-director Daniel Robie. It stars Antoine Olivier Pallon. The film is rated R, and you can watch it available on video-on-demand platforms, including Vudu and Fandango Now. Now a film called Fisherman's Friends. It sounds like a hand cream, but it's not. It's a British comedic drama directed by Chris Fogan and starring Daniel Mays and James Purefoy. Wade?
The delight of the week. This is one of those fantastic working class wish fulfillment dream come true movies that the British do routinely, and they do so well. So if you love The Full Monty, Calendar Girls, Billy Elliot, Brassed Off, any of the films in that subgenre, you will absolutely love this. It's based on the true story of a group of Cornish fishermen who a few years ago were discovered by record executives, and they wound up recording an album of old seamen's shanties, which has since become the biggest selling folk album of all time. And this is the story of, you know, obviously fictionalized to some degree, but the story of those fishermen, the record executive who puts it all on the line to try to bring them their talent to market. There's a romance in it. Of course, it has to be a little bit of a romantic comedy. But you've been here before. You've hit all of these beats before. But it's like an old warm blanket. It just feels so good, and it's so cozy. And if you've been cooped up at home like so many of us have, it's the right movie at the right time.
And how do you make a movie like this without having Bill Nighy in some part? How do they do that?
You know what? They dig up some amazing actors from the UK who stand in for Bill Nighy. I mean, it's a great cast. And you're going to recognize all the faces. But it's really it's a wonderful movie.
Fisherman's Friends is the film. It's directed by Chris Fogan and stars Daniel Mays and James Purefoy. It's rated PG-13. It's available on video-on-demand platforms, including Google Play and iTunes. Now, Stockton on My Mind is a documentary from HBO. It's directed by Mark Levin, and it follows Michael Tubbs' tenure as the first African-American mayor of his hometown, Stockton, California. Leo?
Yes, this is a really fascinating story, and I didn't know that much about it. Tubbs, who is a millennial, was elected mayor of his hometown the same day that Trump was elected. And it became, you know, it was this sort of fascinating study in contrast that this young guy who grew up amid poverty and violence won a scholarship to Stanford and then decided to run for city council in Stockton. And Stockton, by the way, is one of the most troubled cities in the U.S. and has declared the largest city to declare bankruptcy, possibly, and has had, you know, all kinds of economic problems and issues with homelessness and crime. And Tubbs sort of put together a coalition, which is sort of like this dream team almost, to try to solve these problems. And a lot of the initiatives are really, really interesting. There's one called Advanced Peace, where they will take someone who has been incarcerated and sort of, you know, come about learning a different way of life and teach youth who are potentially going to be drawn to a life of crime. They also had economic stimulus initiatives. And the interviews with Tubbs and his staff are really just sort of kind of a fascinating look at a different kind of approach to politics, to solving the problems of a city like Stockton. And I thought for the most part, it's a pretty good doc. I would have liked it to be a little more focused because it sort of meanders a bit. Like there's, you know, at times I wasn't sure whether the focus was supposed to be on Tubbs or on Stockton. And of course, Tubbs and Stockton are very much they're very much intertwined. But, you know, it sort of goes in a few different directions. But for the most part, I think it's a really interesting doc and a look at someone who's going to continue to be a formidable population politician and who I hope continues to turn Stockton around.
Stockton on My Mind is directed by Mark Levin. The documentary is unrated and premieres on all HBO platforms on July 28th. It will be available on video on demand on July 29th. And Kissing Booth 2, I missed Kissing Booth 1, is a teen romantic comedy starring Joey King and Joel Courtney. Vince Marcello directs the film and also wrote the screenplay with J. Arnold Wade. Kissing Booth 2.
Well, I am the person to review a movie aimed squarely at teenage girls, let me tell you that. because I'm the father of one who's going to be a teenage girl within only a few years. So I take a great deal of interest in movies that I don't understand. And I did not see Kissing Booth 1 either, but it was a huge hit for Netflix. So catching up on this, it's actually quite interesting. It's not a very good film, but it's a really engaging film. And it's engaging because Joey King, who stars, is quite a charismatic and engaging actress. You can't take your eyes off her. She's a little bit quirky. She's funny. She's very self-confident. She narrates the film almost as if it's adhering to her diary. And the first Kissing Booth was really kind of a straightforward teen high school romance where a kissing booth at a carnival is how she is able to sort of land the guy of her dreams, who's the older brother of her best friend. And this kind of continues that story. Now the guy, Noah, he's gone to college, and she's a little bit lonely, but she's still in high school. And there are all of these other teenage events that arise. And this has more breakups and makeups and hookups than half a dozen of these movies normally would. It's basically a PG-13 version of what would normally be a Disney Channel teen film. It has all the same rhythms and the same beats and the same kinds of performances. But if you're the age group that this is targeted at, you will find it absolutely wonderful. They don't really hold anything back for a third film. This has, like, climaxes.
Kissing Booth 2 is available on Netflix. It's unrated. More reviews are just ahead on Film Week. Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm John Horn in today for Larry Mantle, and we're joined by our Film Week critics, Wade Major of Cinegods.com, Lael Lowenstein of the Santa Monica Daily Press, and Charles Solomon for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. Now, the documentary Helmut Newton, The Bad and the Beautiful, it takes a closer look at the life and career of the fashion photographer Helmut Newton. The film is written and directed by Gero von Bohm. Lael? Charles, who wants to go?
I'll jump in. I didn't care much for the film or its subject. Newton is famous for taking photos of nude women in high heels and nude women with chains and nude women looking like they're being eaten by alligators, all in the service of things like Vogue selling overpriced clothes that nobody really needs. And a lot of the people in this seem to be spending their time trying to say, oh, this isn't really exploitative, this isn't really objectifying women, when if you look at the photographs, they obviously are. And the really interesting moment in the film is when Susan Sontag, on a talk show in excellent French, dismisses his objections that, oh, I love women. And she said, a lot of misogynists and people who exploit women's images say that. These images are, and you think, right on, Susan, and that's the high point of the film.
Lael?
I partially agree with Charles. I think it's really interesting to have this movie come out the same week as We Are Radical Monarchs, which deals, you know, with actual female empowerment and educating girls on the media representations of women. So since Helmut Newton was such a big part of the media representation of women in magazines like Vogue and other high fashion forums for many decades, it's kind of a fascinating juxtaposition. Whether or not his images are misogynistic, I think it's not quite as clear cut as that. The argument is made that these sort of Amazonian, like very tall, very fit women, among them Grace Jones, and some of these supermodels, Nadja Auermann, Hanna Schygulla, the actress, were depicted naked, but they also had this sort of glassy, glossy, very hard stare that was kind of inviting the male gaze, but also keeping it at a distance at the same time. So the point is made that, yeah, they could be superficially viewed as misogynistic, but there's also a winking quality to his work. I don't know. I think you can argue both sides. The problem that I had with the documentary was just that it became repetitive, that it didn't really do much after about 45 minutes. It sort of rehashed a lot of the same territory. And a lot of the footage was shot quite some time ago, like maybe 30 years ago. I couldn't really tell from whence it came, but it was sort of cut in with a lot of these interviews, that some of which were actually kind of interesting about just the way he worked as a photographer. And Anna Wintour, of course, in her dark sunglasses, talking about working with him. I mean, Helmut was a fascinating artist, and some of his stuff was really crazy and foreshadowed people like David LaChapelle and things like that in terms of some of the wackiness of it. But you know, yes, it's somewhat controversial, his work, and it's a mixed bag as a film.
The documentary is called Helmut Newton, The Bad and the Beautiful. It's from writer-director Jeroen van Boom. You could watch the documentary on Lemley's Virtual Cinema and the Frida Virtual Cinema. Now the British biographical drama Radioactive. It explores the relationship and scientific accomplishments between chemist Marie Curie and her husband Pierre Curie. The film stars Rosamund Pike and Sam Riley. It's directed by Marjan Satrapi. Lael?
So I started out thinking this was sort of just a by-the-book documentary of Marie Curie, and there was one done earlier with Greer Garson that is sort of, I guess, just the standard one up until now. The first half of this documentary I thought was a little bit almost cheesy. There were some moments where it just sort of was over the top in terms of, like, when Pierre and Marie first kiss, there's some sort of electric or fire going on.
So they have sparks, in other words.
Yes, they have sparks. I mean, it was, you know, a little bit too obvious, some of the stuff. And, you know, and I thought, God, this is really not a very original biopic. But then the second half is where it really kind of took off. It explains the fact that Curie was really sort of disliked both by the establishment and by French people. She was originally from Poland, and she was regarded as an immigrant, and they would, you know, tell her to go back to Poland. Pierre, her husband, died in 1906, tragically in an accident. So she outlived him by almost 30 years, and she went on to win the Nobel Prize, not just once, which she did with him, but twice, having discovered radium and polonium with him, and then gone on to do other work on her own. What I thought was really interesting about Satrapi's look at Curie was the way she takes the discovery of radium and polonium and shows sort of the bad that could come of it. She flashes forward to moments like Hiroshima and flashes forward to moments like a child being cured of cancer with chemotherapy, and all of these things became possible because of her discoveries. But there's also, you know, very negative outcome as well that was a result of her work. So it sort of started out very sort of generic and then became kind of really sort of interesting and surprising.
Wade, what was your take?
Yeah, I think those little surrealistic detours were a little, laying it on a little bit thick for me, and I'm trying to be forgiving because Marjan Satrapi is, of course, originally a graphic novelist. She kind of came of age with graphic novels that she then adapted into movies, beginning with Persepolis and Chicken with Plums. Persepolis was animated, Chicken with Plums live action. Since then, she's kind of been all over the map as a filmmaker, and this is a little bit returning to those roots, so I appreciate that she's bringing a certain kind of surrealistic, non-linear sensibility to the story. But that said, it doesn't work as well for me in those moments. I'm a big fan of Marie Curie. I love the old Greer Garson, Walter Pidgeon film. I mean, it's one of the great memories of my childhood. And there was also a Marie Curie film made in France, a French-Polish co-production 4 years ago called Marie Curie, The Courage of Knowledge, starring Polish actress Karolina Gruszka, who is extraordinary. And not to take anything away from this film, which has a lot of lovely stuff in it, but that one feels more authentic, feels closer to who she was, and does a better job, I think, of getting inside the relationship and the characters. Here, it feels like they're just really trying to wrap their arms around an awful lot thematically, in addition to trying to develop the characters, and that sometimes feels like a little bit of a mouthful.
The film is Radioactive. It's directed by Marjan Satrapi. It stars Rosamund Pike and Sam Riley. The film is rated PG-13, and it is streaming on Amazon Prime Video. We continue with Yes, God, Yes. It's a comedic drama. It's Karen Maine's feature directing debut. Natalie Dyer, Timothy Simon, and Wolfgang Novogratz star. Wade, why don't you start us with this one?
Boy, I just kept thinking, I wish this were The Edge of 17, because it reminded me of it, and it felt like a pale imitation of it in many respects. Karen Maine made a short film on this subject in 2017 and went and brought Natalia Dyer back from the short film to star in this. And Natalia Dyer, for anyone who's seen Stranger Things, is a wonderful actress. She has a tremendous presence, especially when she's just emoting and not saying anything. She's still very, very captivating. So you can't help but sort of keep your eyes on her, but I don't know that it gets its tone quite right. It means to be a little bit sardonic in the way that it looks at this girl who's very conservative and has a very kind of sheltered upbringing in the early 2000s and not quite connected to her sense of sexuality and, you know, how boys and girls are supposed to relate. And so she goes to this camp, this very, very Catholic religious camp affiliated with her school, and there, you know, is exposed to a whole litany of things that sort of open her horizons sexually and in terms of relationships. But you're never quite sure, is the film being, you know, intentionally sarcastic? Does it mean to ridicule? Is it being a little bit goofy? The tone is kind of wishy-washy, and it does feel at times like a short film stretched too thin.
Leo?
Yes, pretty much right on, Wade. I did like Natalia Dyer very much. She has, in fact, a very expressive face, and there are many close-ups where she's just sort of not even rolling her eyes, but you can just sort of feel the frustration coming out of her. She was excellent. It feels a bit thin. It feels a bit underwritten. Feels like it really should have been maybe a longer short than it was. But maybe not quite a full feature. And I agree, the tone was kind of the problem. But for the most part, I thought it was charming. And, you know, you could certainly do worse than a Natalia Dyer quasi-comedy.
Yes, God, Yes is written and directed by Karen Maine. It stars Natalia Dyer and Timothy Simon. It's rated R. It's streaming on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. The film will become available on video on demand next week. Next, The Rental. It's Dave Franco's directing debut. He also co-wrote the film alongside Joe Swanberg. The horror thriller stars Allison Brie, Dan Stevens, and Jeremy Allen White. Wade?
Yeah, they're doing this at a bunch of drive-ins, and that's probably the best way to see this. It's about two couples that go for a weekend getaway in an Airbnb, and nothing goes wrong. Isn't that wonderful? Of course not. Two couples go away for an Airbnb, and of course there's a psychopathic killer that's going to, you know, wreak havoc on them once they've turned the suspense screws for about an hour and a half, and that's more or less what happens here. Dan Stevens is a great actor. I don't know why he's necessarily doing this. He elevates the material somewhat, but otherwise it's really pro forma. And everybody, you know, gets upset at everybody else right on cue. And then, you know, murders start right on cue and cars fail to start right on cue. And if you've seen one of these, you've seen this one.
So The Rental 2, if there is such a thing, will be about the Airbnb where the COVID precautions have not taken place and the place is not hygienic when you arrive.
Yeah, probably.
The Rental is Dave Franco's directorial debut. Speaking of drive-ins, you can go see the R-rated film at the Mission Tiki Drive-In in Montclair, the Van Buren Drive-In in Riverside, and Vineland Drive-In in the City of Industry. The film is also available on most video-on-demand platforms. Retaliation is a drama starring Orlando Bloom, Janet Montgomery, and Charlie Creed Miles. It is written and directed by the brothers Ludwig and Paul Shalmassian. Wade?
This is an absolute grueling, grueling sit. I can't say that this is an enjoyable film on any level, but it's not supposed to be. It is a very, very penetrating, heavy look at the toll that sexual abuse takes on an adult psyche. Orlando Bloom has never turned in a better performance, and I'm sure that's why he elected to do this. He's a grown man who still is incredibly crippled by sexual abuse that he suffered as a boy. And this is about reconciling himself to that when the man who abused him returns to the town where he lives. And I shouldn't tell you any more than that, but just understand this film goes, it begins dark and it ends even darker. And there is no redemption. redemption whatsoever in any corner of this film. But again, for those who are willing to take the plunge, that's entirely the point.
So what about Orlando Bloom? Because he's an actor who maybe 10 years ago everybody thought was the next great thing, and then he kind of went away or did some bad movies. Why is this movie important in terms of his career and what he's been doing in the intervening past couple of years?
Well, I mean, he came of age doing, obviously, Pirates of the Caribbean and Lord of the Rings, and those were genre films, those were adventure films, and he was kind of being groomed to be a leading man in an Errol Flynn kind of way. They wanted him to be that that youthful, adventuresome guy who shows up in period films swashbuckling and sword playing and looking good. He eventually aged out of that because there's always someone 5 or 10 years younger who's nipping at your heels. And he didn't have the chance to sort of age into another generation of films. That's what he's trying to do here. He clearly has the talent. It's just a question of whether people will make those parts available.
Coming up on Film Week, my interview with producer and director Linda Goldstein Knowlton. Her new documentary, We Are the Radical Monarchs, looks at the Oakland-based group that's an alternative to the Girl Scouts, specifically for young girls of color. She'll talk about the making of her film and why the merit badges they give their members aren't for things like canoeing or woodworking. I'm John Horn in for Larry Mantle. Film Week continues next here on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm John Horn in for Larry Mantle this week. Earlier in the show, our critics reviewed the new documentary, We Are the Radical Monarchs. It's available now via PBS.org and the PBS app. It tells the story of the Radical Monarchs. They're an alternative to the Girl Scouts, specifically for girls of color. But instead of earning traditional merit badges for things like camping, the Radical Monarchs complete units on social justice and personal empowerment.
I'm going to put you on a group. We're going to do a group activity really quick. I'm going to split it like right down the middle. Decorate the stick figure, and you're going to write all the things society, the media, the movies, commercials say that a boy should look like, act like, and be like. And then this group is doing the same exact thing, except for a girl.
Oh, yeah, they always have to wear, like, sneaker pants.
Like Jordans.
They have to wear pants.
And then they're always just superheroes.
Yeah, they always have to save people.
Wait. I saved my dog.
Girls are supposed to have long hair.
A lot of makeup on. Eyeshadow.
They have to be housewives, whatever that's called.
The group started in Oakland in 2014 and continues to grow in other Bay Area cities as well as around the country. Producer and director Linda Goldstein Knowlton follows the original troupe of Radical Monarchs over the course of 3 years in her film. When we spoke earlier this week, I started by asking her when she first heard about the Radical Monarchs and at what point she decided to make a documentary about them.
Well, I read about them in an article online in The Guardian. And it was when they had just gotten all of this attention because they marched in the first Black Lives Matter march in Oakland. And at the time they were called the Radical Brownies, and they're these gorgeous girls, and they're wearing their Black Panther inspired berets, and they're marching in front of a banner that says Radical Brownies. And so a lot of people took their pictures and, you know, what is this? And most of the attention was very, very good. So So I saw this article, and the article was entitled, "Is This the Future of Girl Troops?" And everything about girls empowerment, women, is all very centered for me in my work and just as a human. So I read the article and I thought, this is an amazing, amazing group, and they're just starting, and this would be an amazing film. I actually thought that it would be great right from the beginning, because as I read the article, they were talking about on Yvette and Marilyn, the co-founders, that they had started this group for 12 girls. And then all of a sudden there is this explosion of attention. So I thought, what is that like for two women who have community organizing jobs, who have families, and now they're kind of being tapped on the shoulder to start a movement? So I thought, I was all in because nobody looks at that part of creating change.
The Radical Brownies name gave way to the Radical Monarchs. I suspect maybe the Girl Scouts of America objected. What was the story about the name change?
Well, thank you, Sean Hannity, actually. In one of the Fox pieces done on them, at the very end of it, he said, "So I called the Girl Scouts of America to see if this is a real brownie troop," which it's not, which they never said it was. And now the Girl Scouts of America know about the Radical Brownies. So they called on Yvette and Marilyn and had a very nice phone call and just said, "We're getting a lot of calls in saying, this is horrible. I really hope you're not doing this in our troop." And the other whole set of calls were, "This is amazing. We want our troops to be doing this." So the Girl Scout of America representative said, "Look, this is a lot of brand confusion. And we actually have the copyright on the word brownie as it pertains to girl groups." So it was a good opportunity because Aunt Yvette and Marilyn didn't want there to be brand confusion either. So they worked with the girls and had them come up with names and they voted on them and they came up with Radical Monarchs.
I want to ask about Aunt Yvette Martinez and Marilyn Hollenquist because they are the people who found the Radical Monarchs, but they're also in some ways entrepreneurs and their startup isn't a cosmetics company or a boutique law firm. What they're starting up is an advocacy organization whose members are very young girls. And part of your documentary is really about what it means to start something as kind of business people in a way, about a business plan and whether they're going to copyright and how they're going to put together lesson plans. Why was that so central to the story that you wanted to tell?
Well, it's a huge part of how do you start a movement? What are the beginnings? What are all the challenges? What are all the behind the scenes things that people don't see, right? So when there was the Women's March, right, people saw the millions of women and men marching, right? You see all of that. And that's also what happened with the Radical Monarchs themselves. They got all of this attention. They got requests from over 200 cities for troops, you know, so it was like, "Wah, what's happening here?" And they couldn't scale that fast because they literally had no money. They're doing this for free. It was a side hustle on their way to being entrepreneurs. And people, because of the amazing things that they were doing and the social media that was out there, people thought, "Oh, they're a fully funded group," which they weren't. And then another part that we show in the film is that as you're starting this non-for-profit entrepreneur kind of idea, it's not like you can just get a grant. You know, you can't get those big giant grants, the multi-year grants. It's very similar to making independent films. You write these giant grants and you get 25 grand. Thank you for the people who gave us 25 grand. However, that doesn't pay the bills. So it was really about, who do you know? It's about who do you know? And so for me, following that aspect of the journey, the creation and the journey and the growth of this group was central because you can't have a group without the work.
We're talking with Linda Goldstein-Knowlton, the director and producer of the documentary, We Are the Radical Monarchs. One of the things that the Monarchs borrow from kind of the history of Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts is this idea of like badges. And one of the things that is different is that these badges require action. It's not something you put on your sash to get points for becoming an Eagle Scout. Part of the rules or the organizing principles are you have to contribute radically to your community. And it's also when you get the badge, the work doesn't stop. And I am a recovering member of the Boy Scouts, and I went back and looked up merit badges. Boy Scout merit badges are things like Indian lore, wood carving. I mean, we can have a long conversation about Indian lore, but it's things that you do that are kind of fun, fingerprinting, canoeing, but it's not about change. So why was that so important to the Radical Monarchs that getting the badge wasn't the end, but kind of the start of your commitment?
Yeah, very different badges. Although a key component to the Radical Monarchs is fun, is joy, that because the work is so hard and because they're kids, right, that joy has to be instilled in the whole process. But speaking to, I mean, that's one of the, my favorite things about them is that when you get the badge, the work doesn't stop.
If you don't mind my saying, ahead of the film's release, you shared a story on Facebook about the health crisis that you were going through in the making of this film. And I'm wondering what the girls taught you about yourself or what lessons you impart, they imparted to you as you're making the movie and dealing with your own health.
I was diagnosed with breast cancer a month after we started making the film. That was something I had never done, before, make a film while going through all of that. And I have to say, it all worked because of my crew, the most incredible collaborators ever. Name them all: Katie Flint, Grace Lee, Claire Major, Giselle Contreras, and Suze Curtis Campbell. Anyway, all of that happened because of the crew. And I'd actually started making two films at the same time. I dropped the other one, and I knew in my soul that I had to keep making this film. And I truly believe it helped me get through all of the treatments, all of the surgeries. And it was an incredible gift for my daughter to be able to see I'm still working, that I still am working on something that I'm so passionate about, and that I'm going to be okay. And also working with the girls, I would look at them, and they're basically the same age as my daughter. So they're giving me so much hope. I would bring that hope home to my family.
That's Linda Goldstein-Knowlton, the producer and director of the new documentary, The Radical Monarchs. We'll have more of my conversation with Linda coming up next on Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. We'll be right back. Glad to have you with us here on Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm John Horn, sitting in for Larry Mantle. We're talking about the new documentary, We Are the Radical Monarchs, with producer and director Linda Goldstein-Knowlton. With the film coming out during our national reckoning on systemic racism, I wanted to know more about what that meant for the timing of the film's release. You are following this group over a number of years, and they're talking about things 3 or 4 years ago. They're talking about police violence, immigration, rent relief. And in the intervening years, if not just weeks and months, those become really important issues in the national conversation. So how do you think the film lands differently, given what's going on in the country today, than had it come out 6 months ago?
Well, as I like to say, they're way before their time, and they're right on time. Kind of so is this film. My brother actually called me after a few weeks after the killing of George Floyd and this reckoning on race in our country. He's like, you should get PBS to air the film right now. And I'm like, okay. So I feel like on the one hand, it's incredibly powerful and hopeful that this film is coming out now, because of this reckoning, and to show that people of every age are affected and can actually take action and be powerful. That's what this group is about. It's empowering young girls of color to step into their brilliance. So on the one hand, you know, I was just talking with Marilyn, and she said it's, you know, history repeating itself. So on the one hand, all of this has been going on for so long in our country, and the fact that we're in this moment where it's really exploding in a fantastic way, finally. It's incredibly exciting and powerful. And I hope that it gives people a lot of hope and a understanding that they can participate and take action too.
It also suggests that there are things that could be taught elsewhere, classrooms maybe, that wouldn't need to be taught outside, things like how to be media literate, how to understand environmental justice, to understand pride, to talk about body image and about representation, because it feels like a lot of the curriculum of the Radical Monarchs is things that might be, in an ideal world, that the kids would learn in school or somewhere else.
That would be wonderful. I mean, I learned about the Tulsa riots from watching Watchmen. It was never in any history books. I've been a social activist for a really long time. I had no clue. So as Marilyn says in the film, you know, if we want the Black Lives Matter movement to be over in 2036, we need to start teaching social justice in schools like we teach STEM subjects. So I just think that people are not getting this curriculum, this education, this understanding and unpacking. I think what they do so brilliantly is they unpack these issues for young girls, because it's not like kids don't know what's going on. It's not like they don't hear and see, right? And they can make up their own stories about it, or they can have understanding, empathetic people explaining it to them and walking through it and asking them, what do they know, instead of just adults talking at them.
We're talking with Linda Goldstein-Knowlton, the director and producer of the documentary, We Are the Radical Monarchs. What happens to audiences if they watch this and are moved? Do they start their own troops? Do they give money? Do they reevaluate sending their kids to Girl Scouts? What do you hope are some of the outcomes?
The thing that they can do is they can go to radicalmonarchs.org and they can do a couple of things. One is they can contribute. It's tax deductible. If they have contacts for other funders, please introduce the Radical Monarchs. You can email them there. And what you'll also find on their website is they have come up over all of these years, they have all of these years, 5 years, they've come up with a way for to scale involving communities helping to start their own troops. So they, since the movie finished, they have launched 4 new troops, 2 in Oakland, 1 in Richmond, and 1 in someplace that I'm forgetting at the moment, which is terrible, San Francisco. Oh my God. And they created a curriculum and a way to train all of the new troop leaders and assistants, and the Radical Monarch alumni are a part of that whole thing of helping to choose the new troop leaders and to train them and be mentors to the next troop. So my long-winded answer is they have a plan that you can now reach out to them and have a troop come to you.
I want to ask you one last thing, and that is about representation. A lot of what we talk about on our show is about why it's important to see people who look like you doing something that you might aspire to do. And there's a moment where the troop goes to the Capitol, and it's very moving about what the kids see and what they do, about how they imagine their own futures. Could you talk a little bit about that sequence and what it meant to you as a filmmaker and to hear the girls see these women of color who are running state government?
I just got goosebumps with that question, because it was so exciting and so powerful and empowering. And those girls just walked in there and they were like, I can be here. I belong here. It was astounding. And the personal experience I had in that moment at the end, we interviewed each of the girls, you know, what did you take from being here and this experience? And there was one girl who'd been very shy the whole time we'd been filming the film, 3.5 years, and would really kind of not look me in the eye when I would interview her. And when I asked her this question, she just looked up and looked me straight in the eye. And she said, I'm going to be governor of California. And, you know, I'm like, try not to cry, you know? And that's what that experience, I mean, you couldn't have believed it. So yes, representation.
You've worked a lot in narrative film, and now you're working in documentaries. What can documentary film do that narrative film can't? Because there's so much of this idea of, like, the imagination in fiction allows us to see a reality that documentary doesn't always do. How would you say that this documentary can tell a story that narrative film can't?
Well, I think that with documentary, you have to be, and you can be, so much more agile in terms of being in the moment. Real people actually, except for maybe science fiction, are open the possibilities to so many more ideas, because it's you're seeing people on the fly reacting, doing, taking you places. It's all about the surprise. Actually, a very smart producer friend of mine, Julie Lynn, said that as a producer of scripted films, your job is to eliminate all surprises for the director. And as a director of documentary, it's your job to be open to all possibilities, to all surprises. So I feel like the human animal is a very surprising thing. And I feel like it gives the opportunity to really connect with someone who is either inspiring you or is having the same experience of you. You don't feel alone. I love scripted films, but I feel like documentary really is a whole other level of exciting.
Linda Goldstein-Knowlton is the director and producer of the documentary, We Are the Radical Monarchs. Linda, great to talk to you.
Thank you. Great to talk to you, too.
That's producer and director Linda Goldstein-Knowlton talking with me about her new documentary, We Are the Radical Monarchs. It's available to stream now on PBS.org and the PBS app. Thanks so much for joining us for Film Week. I'm John Horn in for Larry Mantle. Have a great weekend.